But that was kind of like a sobering reminder that we may be carrying a whole bunch of different pathogens within us, but it's the combined interaction of these other microbes that are keeping us healthy. And so that when there is an imbalance, then there's an opening, you know, for some of these to kind of rear their heads.
Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Bethany Brookshire.
Poo. Crap. Doo-doo. Shit.
Sorry to my poor producer. The stuff that comes out of our butts, or at least I hope it comes out of your butt with some regularity. And if it doesn't, I hope you're seeing someone about that. And also, colostomy bags can be life-saving. For all that poop is undeniably disgusting, we're often weirdly obsessed with talking about it. There's lots of magazine articles that will tell you how often you should poop, how much fiber you should be getting, and the answer is always more, and even offering supplements and teas to improve the experience. There are squatty potties and Metamucil and entire books devoted to the inside of a baby's diaper. But for all of that, how much do most of us really know about our number two? The Browns and the Super Bowl are actually complex mixes of food and microbes. They not only could tell us about our health, they could be the key to a more sustainable future. Here to give us the crap on crap is Bryn Nelson. He's a science writer and former microbiologist who has written for Newsday, The New York Times, Nature, and many other outlets. And he's here now to talk about his new book, Flush, The Remarkable Science of an Unlikely Treasure. Bryn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Bethany. It's a pleasure to be here.
First, I have to say, I was actually struck while reading this book by how regular you are. No offense, but you appear to have no pooping issues. And I kind of figured that a book about poo would have some deep driving intestinal problems that kind of presage your interest, but you don't. And I was wondering what kind of drew you to write about poop?
Well, my background is as a microbiologist, and so I've always been interested in microbes and the human microbiome within us. And I guess I am fairly regular, but I was also really interested in what kind of microbes are inside of me. What are they doing? And you know, I, like other people, would tend to flush and forget. And, you know, I started hearing more stories about the utility of poop. I did a feature story for a British magazine called Mosaic on fecal transplants. And in that case, someone's poop, it can be literally life-saving. You're literally transplanting your microbiome to someone else, and that can save their life if they have a bad bacterial infection. Most often it's Clostridioides difficile or C. diff, and it's a very horrible, often hospital-acquired infection. And I was so fascinated by this substance that, you know, many of us find disgusting. We don't always like to think about it. And in the right place, at the right time, it can be transformative and for many people, absolutely life-saving. So I was just fascinated. And yes, I was also really interested in what was coming out of my body. And I wanted to be more observant. And I guess I'm blessed with being fairly regular. but I did try and experiment, even so, with different supplements and products to see what would happen.
I mean, people's health is kind of the most obvious angle here. People have been contemplating their own crap for a very long time. It's like an early form of meditation. It seems like we're always talking about how we need to poop more, unless we need to poop less. And for some reason, I absorbed in the cultural zeitgeist that people should poop every day, once a day, and more than that is bad, and less than that is also bad. Is this true?
In a short answer, no. And part of that is that what comes out of us is obviously a reflection of what goes into us. And we have many different diets. How often we go and the volume can be a direct reflection of our diets. So how many vegetables are we eating? Do we have a diet that's high in fiber? If you have a diet that's high in fiber, you will tend to poop more often and it will be bulkier. And that's actually normal, if you want to, you know, put quotes around that. It turns out that there's actually a very large distribution curve. And there was a study out of the UK, and they used blue dyed muffins as a marker to see how long it would take to go from your mouth out of your butt. And there was this remarkable distribution among people who describe themselves as healthy, from something less than 10 hours to 7 days. Now, at either end of those extremes, I would think that, you know, that may not be the most desirable. but what it shows is that, you know, anyone who says, you know, you have to go, you know, once a day and it has to be this color and it has to be, you know, this shape, there's nothing that specific about our output. And even, you know, among us, it can vary from day to day, depending on your activity levels. So I think it's more what's happening to you over time. And, you know, can you be observant enough to understand what your body's telling you? So that if you're going, you know, regularly twice a day, and then suddenly you're up to five times a day, you know, maybe that might be telling you something. So that's I think, you know, part of the story of flush is that, you know, we're all different. And there's a great many things that impact our output. There's been a long history of people that have tried to sell us supplements, detox formulations, you know, and convincing us that there's like one right way to poop. and there really isn't. It's whatever is healthy for you over the long haul. And you know, as long as you know, you're reasonably regular over time.
Yeah. And speaking of people trying to sell us things, I've noticed how people are not just obsessed with how often, but also how it looks and how it sounds and how it smells. And you note that Dr. Oz at one point said that our poops need to enter the toilet like perfect silent divers. And I don't know about you, but that is a lot of extra intestinal pressure that I don't need in my life.
That's exactly right. I had a little bit of fun with that because his description was so precise. And that's exactly what I think is the pressure that we don't need, right? You know, like my poop isn't always going to be perfectly bronzed. It's not going to enter the pool like a diver from Acapulco. You know, it's not going to make this certain sound. And it's okay. You know, it doesn't have to be like that, you know, and we have this whole Bristol stool scale, and it goes from, you know, on the one end, constipation, which is not healthy if you have chronic constipation. And on the other hand, if you have chronic diarrhea, we know that those are unhealthy. There are variations in between that, and you can vary accordingly, you know, depending on your diet and the day. But yeah, again, you know, anyone who tells you that your poop has to look exactly like this and sound exactly like this and smell exactly like this on a consistent basis, I think is probably trying to sell you something.
I mean, I have too much to worry about as it is. And now, and so one thing that I really loved is how much self-experimentation you did in this book, kind of trying to play with your poo, mostly without touching it. And so one of the things you did was you actually swallowed a whole tablespoonful of sesame seeds. Yes. And then you also did it with corn to see how fast your gut transit time was.
Yes.
So what'd you get?
So what's really fascinating about this, and I didn't really learn this until I was pretty much done with the book. It also depends on what time of the day you're doing it, right? So the sesame seeds I did in the morning, and you basically take a tablespoon of sesame seeds, you mix them in a glass of water, you know, when you swallow them, and then you can see when they come out the other end, because sesame seeds are largely undigested. And so they're pretty apparent. And so in that case, it was about 16 hours. So pretty, you know, on the little bit of the faster side, but still kind of within, you know, your kind of standard of deviation. And then I tried it with corn. So corn also works, right? Because the outer layer is mainly in cellulose, and so we can't digest it as well. And so, yes, corn tends to be apparent on the other end as well. And in that case,
was this cooked corn or
it was cooked corn. It was cooked,
like canned.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, corn on the cob. You know.
Okay. Yeah.
And in that case, I generally had that for dinner. But what I realized is that in that case, it was more like 24 hours. But that's because I was doing it in the evening. And your body has these cycles. And so your intestinal tract is more active, of course, during the day. And then things tend to quiet down at night, right? So there's this 8-hour window. And so, of course, it made sense that depending on when I was doing this test throughout the day, I would either hit that window or I'd have to wait until, you know, basically the gastrointestinal system is more active. So that was just kind of an interesting aha moment, you know, and there's this 8-hour difference, but that makes sense because you have this natural cycle, you know, morning, evening. And so anyway, but that's an easy way to do it. You can do it with food dye as well. If you go to the doctor, a lot of times they do these more expensive and extensive pills. Some of them actually have cameras that they can take pictures as they're going through you. But if you just kind of want to get a sense of where you're at, different food items actually work pretty well.
Oh my goodness. You know what I just realized? You know how intermittent fasting is like having a moment? I will bet at some point there's going to be some intermittent fasting diet guru who's going to be like, okay, so first you're going to take sesame seeds at these times, then you're going to find your optimal gut motility, and you're only going to eat during those gut motility times. Oh no. Oh no.
I mean, there are products for just about anything that you can think of having to do with our gastrointestinal tract. So I don't doubt that there will be more people trying to monetize some aspect of this. But I think that's another reason. I mean, you know, again, that's why we should be careful, right? If you're educated about how your body actually works, and if you train yourself to be observant about what goes in and what comes out, I think you're going to be less susceptible if someone's trying to sell you some snake oil.
So, speaking of education, you were talking about kind of your gut transit time, which turned out to be between about 16 and 24 hours. What are the things that kind of determine that gut transit time? What are the steps between a food entering your mouth and coming out the other end as a brown mass full of corn?
Well, the act of digestion is actually quite complicated, and we know the main steps along the way. But I think what's really fascinating is that we still don't entirely know all of the details. You know, there's still even some debate over what may or may not be a new set of salivary glands that were just discovered. So we're still discovering these aspects of digestion, which I think is just remarkable that we know the basics. We also know that things move through us slightly different based on the amount of protein, carbohydrates, at least in terms of how quickly they can be digested. You know, for very simple carbohydrates, you're actually starting the digestion in your mouth with the salivary glands. And so this is a process that, you know, includes the stomach, also the small intestine is doing a lot of the digestion and absorption. And then you start getting the involvement of a lot of your gut microbes. And so those are going to be breaking down things like fiber. They're going to be helping you synthesize vitamins. They're going to help regulate the water content in your gut. And we know that for men and women, the transit times are somewhat different depending on the stage of digestion. So women tend to have a slightly longer transit time than men do. And that may then help explain why women may be slightly more susceptible to constipation, whereas men might be slightly more susceptible to diarrhea or, you know, some of the problems with a lower transit time. So there's a lot of different factors. Of course, obviously diet plays a big role in this as well. and again, you know, not to plug fiber, but when you have more fiber in your diet, that can literally act like a broom to help kind of sweep things toward the exit doors. And so that can help regulate your transit. And, you know, it can actually help move things along. But by adding the bulk along the way, it can actually also help from things going too fast. So it's kind of your modulator between too fast and too slow. So I think you know the whole process is fascinating to me. We're learning a lot more about how the gut microbes may influence this, and I think there's a lot left to learn, which is really fascinating to me, you know, even about something as seemingly straightforward as digestion.
Well, and something I don't think this ended up mentioned in the book, but for example, in women, their point in the menstrual cycle, the hormonal status, mm-hmm. has a strong impact on how one poos, yep. As well as, you know, things like fiber and yep. what you've eaten, spicy food, yep. coffee, you know, kale, all of that sort of thing. Yep. And actually, so speaking of fiber, people in less developed countries, you noted, have higher poop volumes. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that that was because of a kind of higher fiber diet. And I was wondering how much is our concept of how much we poo and how much we should poo and what volume we should poo and so on. Like, how much of that is a result of culture? Mm-hmm. As opposed to biology, like the culture of, you know, what's culturally in your diet?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think, you know, a lot of it, I would say, has to do with who has been included in a lot of the research studies. And if you look back at some of the research studies, it was people in wealthier countries. They were often white and they were often men. And so if you're looking at that, you know, of course, you're going to get a very narrow snapshot. And so, you know, it's sort of ridiculous to suggest that, okay, well, this is normal, right? And everything outside that is abnormal. Well, of course not. It has to do with who you're including and who you're actively excluding from some of these studies. So part of it is just based on a complete lack of diversity in a lot of these early studies, that we're missing the natural variation among people. I think the other thing is that diet is very culture specific. And we know that diet plays such a big role in, basically how we digest our food and what comes out the other end. So if you have a diet that is going to be meat and potatoes, that's going to look vastly different from someone who is eating a lot of cassava, beans, rice, high fiber foods like that. So I think what has happened that is encouraging is that you're seeing a lot more attention being played to what's the role of diet? What's the role of culture? Are you exposed to antibiotics or not? Because chronic exposure to antibiotics also plays a role by influencing your gut microbiome. And I think there's, you know, good evidence to suggest that in many developed countries, our high fat, low fiber diets, as well as our sedentary lifestyles, as well as our frequent exposure to antibiotics, are actually causing us to lose a lot of the diversity in our microbiome. And as such, a lot of the potential function of those microbes as well. So yeah, long answer to your question, but yes, I think culture can be extremely important in how we think about this.
And actually that, you know, now I think it's very clear. We know a lot about how white men poop. We're very good mm-hmm. at that. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, have there been any studies that you know about the effect of age? Because as you noted in the book, for your 50th birthday, someone gave you Metamucil. This is a thing that happens. You hit middle age and people start talking about constipation.
Exactly.
Are there known studies about age and pooping?
That's a really interesting question. I didn't look specifically at kind of how that changes. I know that, you know, some motility disorders can be associated with, you know, different conditions that may have an age association. So there may be sort of an indirect, connection there. I think maybe also people reach a point where they decided they're going to talk about their bodily functions, you know, and so maybe it's just more apparent in our discussions that we're more used to people reaching a certain age and then just sort of, you know, talking about their pooping habits, and it's true, right? Because if you're a young parent, you're kind of obsessed with your baby's poop. And, you know, what's the color? What's the volume? What's the smell? You know, why is it this color and not that color? You know, you pay a lot of attention to that. At a certain point, you know, we kind of forget about it. And then later in life, you know, we kind of discover it again, I guess, you know, and particularly after, if you've had like a surgical procedure, you know, because one of the first signs that things are getting back to normal is, have you had a proper bowel movement? And, you know, we use that as a marker of recovery. So I think, you know, some of it is just, you know, what is maybe acceptable or unacceptable for us to talk about. But that's a good question. I didn't delve specifically into kind of what are the curves look like as you age in terms of like transit time or other attributes.
But as you know, we've mentioned, you know, you get to a certain age where you just don't give a crap anymore about your crap.
And
this is really interesting because a lot of people listening to this might feel more than a little grossed out. And I'll admit, like, I was trying to read this book while I was eating. Don't do that. do not do that. and so I love that you ended up discussing disgust. Mm-hmm. Which is something that I have also ended up digging into for my own research purposes. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about it. Disgust is yes. part of what scientists call the behavioral immune system. What does that mean?
So one of the theories of how disgust developed as an emotion, and it's a very potent, it's a very strong emotion, is to help us avoid things that might hurt us. And so we're acquainted with the immune system as a way of fighting off infections. The behavioral immune system is sort of a complement to that. And the idea is that if you are repulsed by something, you are more likely to avoid it. And that avoidance has a beneficial role. So bodily fluid, so poop, pee, vomit, you know, someone who has a runny nose, you know, someone who looks unwell, cockroaches, rats, things that could spread disease, there is this kind of knee-jerk aversion to that. And so the idea is that this behavioral immune system is keeping you safe from things that can harm you. Now, of course, it can be dialed up too high, and we know that it can have unintended consequences as well. But the basic idea is that, you know, we have this aversion for a reason to help to protect us.
Yeah, I believe Paul Rosen, who's one of the major scientists who studies disgust, mm-hmm. refers to it as oral rejection, which is about the most Freudian phrase I have ever heard.
Yes, yes.
You can just see a dude with a very strong Austrian accent talking about your oral rejection problems.
Exactly.
And I was wondering, you know, are people who have a stronger sense of disgust healthier?
Ah, that's a good question. I think, you know, if you look at certain communities, there is this kind of correlation with as your threats change, you know, do your measures of disgust change to kind of help you meet these threats, right? And so there have been some studies suggesting that in certain communities, people with higher disgust levels, yes, can avoid certain pathogens. I think the question is now, you know, we're pretty acutely aware of like how to avoid specific diseases. So I guess the question is now for modern society, does disgust still have that same potent protection that it used to have for our ancestors? And I think that's a question that is suggesting that maybe the connection is a little murkier. But yes, theoretically, it would help you, you know, avoid some of these pathogens. But again, the flip side is if you're associating specific diseases with specific groups of people, and you don't see yourself as that among that that group of people, disgust may actually give you a false sense of security, because then you are thinking, okay, well, I don't belong to that group of people. They're the ones that are more susceptible to this disease, and I'm less susceptible. So we saw that, for example, with COVID. And so, you know, initially, there was a lot of xenophobia. There was a lot of animosity directed towards Asian people. And so associating COVID as a disease in that community can give you then the false sense that you're less susceptible to it. And the same is true for monkeypox. So monkeypox, at least so far, has disproportionately affected the LGBT community. And so people who would suggest, oh, this is a gay disease, I'm not as susceptible to that, can give themselves a false sense of security that this is not something that, you know, they're going to get. So it can work against you as well. And I think we're seeing that. So there is this kind of, you know, double-edged sword there.
Well, and it also leads to a lot of problematic behaviors, right? Like that right. kind of disgust is often connected with, I think, what is usually called moral disgust, mm-hmm. right? And moral disgust is things that are morally nasty to us, and therefore we are disgusted by them. And so like the acceptable version of this is things like incest is morally disgusting. Mm-hmm. But people will also kind of expand that to outgroups, mm-hmm. right? And so you will have actual measures of disgust detected in people who are virulently racist, mm-hmm. For example.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is awful. Like, that is terrible. mm-hmm. But it also shows you that you know, disgust can affect not just kind of what we see, but also very much how we behave.
Right. And I think part of the antidote to that is understanding how disgust works and understanding that we're more than just our emotions. You know, so yes, it's true. You can have moral disgust, pathogen disgust, and then I think the other one is sexual disgust. And yes, if you score higher on these scales, in particular the pathogen disgust, there is a correlation that you may be more likely to be xenophobic, for example, because of the fear that this other person is going to bring in disease, you know, in part. But we also know that people can get past that by, you know, personalizing, by, you know, understanding who the people are in this other group, you know, that they have names, they have identities, you know, you get to know them, you understand that they're not the threat you might have thought they were. So part of this kind of maybe blunting of this other, the downside of disgust is just kind of being aware of how it works and how we can, you know, get used to things that used to disgust us. You know, so going back to the example of baby diapers, right? You know, I talked to parents who, you know, basically confided in me that they dry heaved when they, you know, they first were having to change their baby's diaper. But you get over that over time because you care about that infant, and you have to do it in order to care for, you know, that child. And so, you know, through habituation, through this kind of exposure over time, that emotion can lessen. And so I think that's the hopeful thing, is that, you know, yes, there are these undesirable side effects, but that's, you know, that's not a given. We can get over those.
So I actually wanted to pursue the whole babies and disgust angle a little bit, because it does seem to me that humans kind of have more than their fair share of disgust, especially when it comes to poop. And what's interesting to me is that we are not born with this, right? Babies and toddlers are not generally disgusted by poop. They will stick their hands down their own diapers. They will put anything in their mouths if you do not take the dog poo away.
That's right.
And this is interesting because there are many species that are not humans that eat poop.
Right.
Not just dogs, some primates, a lot of rodents. And so I was wondering, you know, it does seem that there are some benefits, for example, to actually ingesting poop, most particularly in terms of things like seeding the microbiome, which we're going to talk more about. So why do humans kind of have this deep, avid disgust?
Oh, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, it is true that there seems to be an age below which babies will happily eat something that is presented to them as poop. So there was a famous experiment by Paul Rosen again, and he basically had peanut butter and I think it was Limburger cheese that was mixed together, but it was presented to young kids as dog poop.
And I gotta be clear, that sounds about equally as disgusting.
Yeah,
no,
right.
No,
it's disgusting, but edible.
Don't go together.
but edible. But there was
theoretically.
Theoretically. But there was a very specific cutoff. So kids below a certain age were like, oh yeah, this is great. You know, to your point, they weren't disgusted, but above a certain age, they were. And they were like, ugh, no, gross, get it away. So I think the suggestion is that there is this kind of broad framework that we have, that evolution has given us. And then cultural cues kind of help fill in the gaps, you know, the blanks. But what's interesting is that poop is sort of universal. You know, it doesn't matter which culture you go to, it's kind of at the top of the list around the world. So that was part of what was interesting to me is, you know, poop is this sort of universal thing that almost all of us have agreed is disgusting. And yet, to your point, a lot of these other animals will ingest it. And the idea is that, yes, it can help provide nutrients, it can help seed the microbiome. And some of these other animals are, it's basically akin to a fecal transplant, if you think about it.
Yeah. And this is really interesting because, you know, as you mentioned, it's one of those things that most people are disgusted by. But at the same time, it is also something that a lot of people have thought about in terms of medicine. Mm-hmm. Poop has been used as medicine mm-hmm. through history. And so, for example, we think of fecal transplants as like the cool new hotness in terms of medicine. And it's really not. You actually noted that the first fecal transplant we know of actually took place in China in the 4th century. And it worked. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, what did they do?
Oh, so it was basically a soup. they would sometimes use kind of these euphemistic terms for it. I think one of them was yellow dragon soup. And it was usually from a child. And it was basically a suspension and broth. And it was used for a number of different things. And I think the list of applications kind of grew. So, you know, to the point where, you know, many of them were probably, a little bit far afield from what was actually happening internally.
But makes your hair shiny.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But at least as far as we know, one of the earliest documented uses of fecal transplants. And so for gastrointestinal issues, it appeared to be sort of this miracle cure. And then was, you know, picked up by later doctors in China, and it was referenced again later in history. And then, you know, kind of gradually slowly spread through the world. It's a very common thing in veterinary medicine now, especially in ruminants like cows and sheep, where you can actually transplant the kind of partially digested food and kind of the fluid in the rumen from one animal to another who is ailing. And of course, you're also then transplanting some of those microbes. And that's this technique called transfaunation, I believe is what it's called. That has existed since, the medieval period in Italy, I think it was. So a lot of these concepts have quite a bit of history to them. And I think it's basically something that we kind of forgot about for a while, and then just kind of rediscovered. And, now, of course, fecal transplants are solidly in mainstream medicine, and there's all kinds of applications that are being tested for now.
And fecal transplants, of course, rely on the concept of the gut microbiome, which has become such a buzzword lately in scientific mm-hmm. coverage that Gastropod Podcast gave it its own drinking game. Which it absolutely deserves. And of course, for science, you had your own gut microbiome sequenced. How'd you do?
I did. You know, what was funny is that I was actually sort of like cramming for this, like a test, which I, you know, in hindsight was kind of hilarious, but I had this idea that, you know, I was going to get, you know, the most number of species that I could. And so I was eating yogurt. I was taking this probiotic supplement. I was eating fiber. I had a lot of vegetables. And so there were about, I think, 180 species in my gut. And I was absolutely fascinated by this because, you know, I was basically sort of geeking out about, you know, okay, what are the most prevalent ones? And, you know, what are these other species and what do they do? And one of the things that was really astounding to me is that, you know, maybe half of the species, we have no idea what they do. You know, so they would say, here's the name of the species, and then here's something about it, basically, you know, isolated from the poop of a healthy 25-year-old. And that's it. You know, we don't really have any more idea than that. And so to me, just like the potential is enormous, but also we really don't have a great sense of what individual species are doing, let alone how they're interacting together in communities. And so I think there's a lot of promise there, but I think then that also requires a lot of caution when people are saying, oh yeah, you know, it can make your hair shiny and, you know, it can make you thin and, you know, all of these things that we're attaching to the microbiome as this sort of like wonder drug. When in essence, it's this very complicated ecological system. I mean, it's, you know, I like to think of it as this kind of miniature rainforest in our gut. You have predators, you have prey, you have keystone species, which are the most important ones, and they'll recruit others or keep others at bay. So there's this fascinating diversity and interaction. And we're just, you know, at the point of learning about this. And one of the other things that was just really interesting to me and actually a little bit disturbing was, you know, I had done a lot of reporting on C. diff, which is this, you know, bacterial infection and of which fecal transplants can be life-saving. And the report actually indicated that I had a small amount of C. diff in my gut as well. So I was actually a transient carrier of this microbe at the time, but it was at a small enough level and the rest of my gut microbe was sufficiently balanced that it was keeping it at bay and I didn't have any symptoms, you know, and I haven't since. But that was kind of like a sobering reminder that we may be carrying a whole bunch of different pathogens within us, but it's the combined interaction of these other microbes that are keeping us healthy. And so that when there is an imbalance, then there's an opening, you know, for some of these to kind of rear their heads. So that was really sobering for me and then made me grateful for the other microbes in my gut that were working. And then the one very last thing that was really astounding to me is, you know, after kind of cramming for this test and doing all of these things, I had this probiotic that had 10 different species of microbes. Not a single one appeared in my gut. In fact, what did appear in my gut were some of the microbes from the yogurt. And so what that suggests, you know, who knows, maybe this probiotic, you know, maybe they weren't actually live cultures, maybe there weren't enough of them. But it also suggests what a lot of researchers have said, which is it's more important to eat fiber and more important to eat these fermented foods in the context of actual food. Instead of just as pills, because they're more likely to actually take in your gut and do something.
Well, and also this is something that I think about a lot as a like scientific and also skeptical person. You know, there's a long path between your mouth and your butt.
Yep.
And when you're taking antioxidants, for example, by mouth or bacteria or something by mouth, they are going to go through a whole series of pHs and mechanical breakdown and biological breakdown. And I mean, odds are that stuff is just not going to dramatically end up in your bloodstream or in your poop.
Right.
You know?
Right, like, right.
Putting something in one end does not mean you're going to see it at the other.
Right. I mean, there's this whole torture chest or torture test for microbes on your way through, right? You know, we know that the stomach has a very low pH, which a lot of the microbes don't survive. So, right. So the ones that actually make it to your gut are the hardy survivors. And they're probably only a fraction of what you started with. So, you know, and that's, you know, by, you know, that isn't a coincidence, you know, that is to help, you know, protect us from pathogens as well. But yes, it suggests that, you know, a lot of these supplements, you know, that aren't well regulated, you know, you don't really have a good sense of, you know, whether any of these little microbes are going to make it to where they need to be. So I think that's another reason for caution. Yeah.
And this actually kind of leads me to one of the things that your book kind of highlighted to me is that the microbiome, particularly like the kind of intestinal microbiome, is both astonishingly flexible and also really not flexible at all. So for example, you know, when you have a C. diff infection and you need a fecal transplant, you will get a completely different set of microbes, mm-hmm. and it can clear up some people's C. diff infections overnight. They are miracles. They are amazing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you also talked with a scientist who analyzed the microbiome of his own poo for literal years. And he described these amazingly rapid gut microbiome shifts when he ate certain things. Mm-hmm. But at the other end, it just snapped right back to what it was. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the people who get the fecal transplants report being symptom-free for years. Why don't they snap back? Why some guts snap back and others don't?
Right. So part of that has to do with the concept of balance or biosis or dysbiosis. So if you think about people who have a C. diff infection, that's an extreme example of a gut dysbiosis. Their gut is out of balance, and it is allowing the C. diff, you know, kind of like this weedy bacteria, if you will, to sort of invade this garden that would otherwise be more or less in balance. If you're able to reseed that tract and restore that balance, then you can kind of keep that C. diff and other pathogens at bay. So that's you know, so in that example, you know, what the gut microbiome is wanting, for lack of a better word, is this kind of balance. And, you know, you can do that with different types of species because there's a lot of overlap in function. At the same time, if you're eating a different diet, so for example, the researcher that I went to had been traveling in Thailand and eating a completely different range of foods. His gut microbiome shifted when he was there in response to the diet. But then when he returned to the United States, then it shifted back. And so, yes, there is this kind of, you know, temporary shift to accommodate what you're eating, and then you kind of go back. But what you're going back to is this sort of relative balance. So does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think the comparison to the ecosystem is actually a very good one, right? When you have an ecosystem that is not under a lot of stress, so it is generally doing pretty well, and you plonk down, say, an invasive species in it, mm-hmm. that invasive species is going to have a heck of a harder time getting a toehold in a very healthy ecosystem. Whereas if you have an ecosystem that is undergoing a lot of human-caused stress, and you plonk an invasive species down in there, the invasive species is going to be like, yes!
Exactly right. And yes. And so basically your goal in doing a fecal transplant for something like a C. diff is to create a hostile environment for that invader, right? And what a hostile environment for that invader is basically a well-functioning, well-balanced ecosystem. you know, that is basically crowding it out. So as you get to kind of other conditions, though, you know, such as like autoimmune diseases, colitis, Crohn's disease, where fecal transplants are being used as well, the mechanism may be a little bit more complicated. And so it may be not enough to just crowd out the bad actors, but to actually then also provide some sort of combination of chemicals, of products, bacterial products or other products that can, you know, shift the balance such that you're not attacking your own cells.
And, you know, the fecal transplants, as you note, can be lifesavers in terms of treating things like C. diff. I was also really struck by how hard of a time they have had in terms of regulation and uptake. And in part, that's actually because of scientific revulsion. And I was wondering how much of that do you think arises not from, you know, disgust. You'd like to think scientists are not susceptible to disgust, but they totally are. From the, I wonder how much of the disgust actually arises from the uncontrolled nature of the fecal transplant, right? Because it's literally poop. It's everything in it, including the bacteria and the viruses. It is not a pure thing that science has carefully designed.
Absolutely. So yes, as I note, it's a regulatory nightmare because it isn't one thing. I mean, you're talking about, you know, 200 different bacterial species, you know, or 150 to 200, but yeah, you know, and you don't know exactly what a lot of them are doing, and you're taking a much more ecological approach to medicine than medicine is used to. And that's a big shift. So it's not this kind of silver bullet, you know, here's the problem and we're going to resolve it with, you know, drug X or remedy Y. It's this whole rebalancing. And I think that has taken, you know, doctors a while to get comfortable with. And, you know, even now there's been this tension between trying to pare down the number of microbes and so experiments saying, okay, well, is it these 50 microbes that are really doing the bulk of the work in a fecal transplant? And if so, can we just give someone these 50 in a you know, more refined method than a fecal transplant? But that's been a really hard thing to do because, again, you're talking about this kind of community. So yes, I think that absolutely is playing a big role as well. And I think, you know, most doctors have kind of gotten past the revulsion because they've seen just how remarkably effective the therapy can be. But now the problem is, okay, well, can you kind of refine the essence of what is actually you know, doing the trick here? And is there a way for us to perhaps do a refined fecal transplant so that it's more palatable to people?
And so that's really interesting. Kind of the palatability kind of goes with another theme that I actually really noticed kind of through this book, and it's the theme of purity. The theme of kind of cleanliness. And that actually kind of gets me onto the topic of biosolids and reuse of sewage, which you spend a lot of time on in the book and I found really fascinating. First of all, what are biosolids and what can we use them for?
Great. So yes, biosolids are basically the organic matter that is left after a wastewater treatment process. So it's poop. And in particular, poop is actually made up quite a bit of bacteria. So 30 to 40% of the dry weight of poop is actually bacteria. So a lot of the organic matter is actually microbes. You also have other organic matter that may have been flushed down the toilet, or is the food fibers that are in us, and we're
the corn.
The corn, exactly.
The corn.
what's left of the corn, which the microbes can digest quite well, and other bits of organic matter. You have some sand, you have some nutrients, but it's basically the combined organic matter that has been reduced from what it was and degraded by the microbes into simpler forms of carbon. So it's this kind of organic matter. And so what it can be used for, which I think is really astounding, is a growing list of things. One of the principal ones is you can digest this matter in these big biodigesters. And what they're doing is they're essentially mimicking the conditions of the gut. So it's anaerobic, which means there's no oxygen, which is the condition that a lot of these microbes like. And there are particular microbes called archaea microbes. And as part of their metabolism, they will take bits of food that are left over from other bacteria. And as part of kind of chomping away on this food and then releasing these metabolites, they produce methane gas. And so these big biodigesters that are at wastewater treatment plants, among other facilities, livestock facilities, you can actually create renewable biogas. And biogas can then be used to generate electricity, heat, biofuels. So there are actually wastewater treatment plants that are using their biogas to power buses, other vehicles. You can even refine biogas into a fuel that could be used as a rocket fuel. So you could literally help astronauts blast off through the power of poop. So that is a really great application and a growing application. There are other things that you can also extract. You can extract phosphorus from poop, from biosolids. And phosphorus, if it goes where it shouldn't, can actually be a really harmful environmental pollutant because it's a nutrient, and in excess, it can cause this sort of explosion of algae growth. And so in some waterways, this sort of explosion of algae growth, these harmful algal blooms, have actually created dead zones because they are using up all of the oxygen in that part of the water. And we have seen that in a number of different bodies of water throughout the world. And that can be an environmental catastrophe. And so phosphorus and nitrogen are the two main ones there. Those can be recovered. And phosphorus, for example, can be recovered and reused as a fertilizer for farms. In the same way, you can actually convert biosolids into compost and fertilizer. And you can do so either on farms and in forests to help regenerate the growth of trees, like after a forest fire, for example. Or you can also then heat treat them or compost them in such a way that you're killing off all of the microbes. And then that can be safely used for gardens, for home gardens. So I actually use them on my own vegetable gardens and flower gardens.
And I was actually thinking about this because, of course, we can get these biosolids because we poop in toilets. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of species do not poop in toilets.
Right.
What do you think the effect has been? As humans, we are now some of the planet's most prolific poopers, and we have literally taken our crap home.
Yep.
What has that done, removed kind of from the ecosystem? I mean, it's also done things like put all of our sewage into rivers, which is bad.
Right.
What have we taken away?
Right. So nature for millions of years has had these remarkably efficient recycling systems. So, you know, the phosphorus cycle, nitrogen cycle, the water cycle. And so all of these things have existed, and poop has always been a part of that natural process. You know, animals live, they die, they decay. Those nutrients go into the soil. But while they're alive, the nutrients from the poop also go into the soil. And in fact, there's been this really interesting research by Chris Dowdy. He's at the University of Northern Arizona, I believe. And looking at these megafauna from thousands of years ago and how central they were in transporting phosphorus around the world and basically distributing the nutrients. And they were actually actively a part of this recycling system. So the loss of those megafauna really had a huge impact on the disruption of this recycling system. And then we come into play and we're like, nope, we're just going to put all of our stuff in landfills where they're the least useful. And so we are actively departing these cycles of recycling. And I think it's had a huge consequence on the ability of nature to regenerate. And so, you know, by rejoining this cycle, we're kind of understanding that, yeah, you know, nature has had this good thing going for a while. We were kind of the odd ones out and saying, nope, we're good. We're gonna opt out. We're gonna put our stuff over here because we're, you know, disgusted. We don't want to think about it. And we've literally put it in the least useful place that we can think of. And so, you know, by rethinking what it is and what it can do and how we can kind of rejoin these cycles, you know, I think we can kind of reclaim some of that power.
Yeah. And you also talk about, for example, developing drinking water from sewage water, which actually results in water that is so pure, it is actually not especially safe to drink. You have to add minerals and salts back. You know, and interestingly, disgust comes in again. People are afraid to drink it and they feel better about it when it's gone through like a wetland or groundwater, even though that actually makes it less pure.
Yep.
And this idea of purity is kind of interesting because it's one of the driving themes in your book is that we have these current ideas of what is valuable. Mm-hmm. And what is clean and what is progress? And you say that these ideas are holding us back from using poop effectively. Yeah. And I was wondering, what is it that we value and what we think is progress that stops us from using our own waste?
Great question. I think there's been this sense that progress and value comes in the form of this sort of tangible new product, you know, new app, new technology, instead of rethinking what we already have. And so, you know, I think the purification of wastewater is a great example, because what do we have in abundance? Well, we have wastewater in abundance. You know, we have poop in abundance. We're always going to poop. As long as we're here on the planet, we will always have that natural resource, right? And so we can say, oh, gross, let's you know, dispose of it somewhere, or we can decide that we're going to use it for good and for progress. And so part of it is kind of getting past our notions of you know, what does value actually, what does it mean? And how can we extract that from things that may not be, you know, particularly shiny or attractive, but have a lot of potential to them? And so for water, one of the really interesting things and sort of like the evolution and how this has come about is you had a lot of communities that were so disgusted by the idea of recycling wastewater that they killed these projects. Of course, now drought and global warming have basically dried up a lot of these available sources of fresh water. And so in desperation, people are looking back and saying, oh, well, what else do we have? Well, we have wastewater. And so there is this kind of curve that you have to get over of, you know, in some cases, maybe the desperation is such that you have kind of rediscovered this thing that's been there all along. But even so, some of these groundwater replenishment systems have to put the water in the ground and then it comes back out of the ground, and then it's magically water. So yes, to your point, you know, it is so pure, it's basically distilled water. But one of the fun things is that in thinking about what has value, if you give someone a sample of this water, they may be less likely to want to drink it. But if you give it to them in the form of a beer, then they will get past their disgust because they're like, oh, a beer. Yeah, free beer. Okay, I'll try that. And in fact, brewers love this this cleansing of wastewater because it's literally a blank slate when you're done treating it. And so you can recreate any kind of beer you want. You can recreate the water profile of any city in the world. You know, there are recipes for that. And then you can create all of these really interesting beers. And so what has happened is you're kind of shifting what that water is to something that's more acceptable to people. You give them a free beer, and then you can talk about the process of, you know, what it took to create that. And that has actually been really effective in getting people past this kind of disgust barrier. So I think, you know, part of it is just really kind of understanding what are our problems, what do we have available to us as tools, how do we think long term about kind of how we can get to some of these solutions, and how do we help people get past some of these barriers, including disgust. And that's going to require not just technology and engineering, but also bringing in some of the social sciences, you know, psychology, sociology, because it's all well and good if you have this technology, but if no one wants to use it, you know, you're not making progress, right? You have to bring people along with you and educate them and explain why it's so important. But I think it's a rethinking of how we're going to move forward. And it's not just always about this, you know, disruptive new technology, but maybe the progress is rethinking how we can much more efficiently use what we already have literally inside of us.
Well, Bryn, I could talk about this for ages. We barely got to like half of this book. Thank you so much for being here and for sharing all this crap with us. At the risk of earning another bleep from the producer, it's good shit.
Thank you so much, Bethany. It was a pleasure. And yes, there's a load more in the book.
As it were. If you'd like to learn more about Bryn Nelson and his book, Flush, The Remarkable Science of an Unlikely Treasure, we've got links available for you at scienceforthepeople.ca. That's our website. You know it well. You can also subscribe to the show. We'd love a review or two just to let us know how we're doing. You can follow us on Twitter or Facebook for updates. And if our show means a lot to you and you want to help keep it going, we've got a Patreon page where you can support our podcasters with a monthly donation or make it a one-time thing. No matter what, thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time on Science for the People.
Science for the People is listener supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. We get help with special projects from K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Anika Hazra, Marion Kilgour, and me, Rochelle Saunders.